What's up, guys? This is Mike Cashew. This is the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interviewed Chris Henshaw, endurance coach and owner of aerobiccapacity.com. Chris and I met when we collaborated training NorCal CrossFit in 2014 for the games. And I knew how passionate this guy was after a probably 45-minute to an hour phone call where he talked over my head the entire time about maximizing efficiency and different oxidative pathways and other things that I don't really understand. So I knew that we wanted to collaborate with this guy more in the future. We brought him on as our endurance coach, and he's done a phenomenal job with all of our athletes from Brooke Entz and Tommy Hackenbrook all the way to our daily clients. He works with over 24 individual games athletes like Rich Froning, Matt Frazier, Camille LeBlanc, and Lindsey Valenzuela. You're at a very big disadvantage if you're not working with Chris Henshaw and you're going to the games. It's come to that point. In this show, we talk about the difference between the two most well-known forms of endurance training, VO2 max and lactate threshold training, and how personalized paces make a big difference in your training. I hope you enjoy the show, and if you haven't already, go and follow our newsletter or subscribe to our newsletter at www.brutestrengthtraining.com, and we're going to be sending out lots of updates and free shit like free squat programs, pull-up progressions, etc. What's up, guys? This is Mike Cashew. This is the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with Chris Henshaw. He is the Brute Strength endurance coach, as well as probably 75% of games athletes now. He's monopolizing the game. He also owns Aerobic Capacity, which is an endurance only website where you can get personalized endurance programs and whatnot. You want to tell us a little bit about who you work with, who you have worked with, that kind of thing?
Sure. So without a doubt, I'm an endurance coach into the CrossFit community. My main background is in endurance sports. Prior to CrossFit, I was a triathlete. I specialized in longer distance races, Ironman distance races, back a long time ago. So long ago, it probably doesn't even count. But placed second in the Ironman World Championships. And what I've done is...
What year was that?
1985. And then my last race was the World Championships in 89, and I placed second there. And for me, what I've done is I've really leveraged my knowledge within the endurance side of the equation. And I've been doing CrossFit now coming up on 7 years. And really correlated a lot of that baseline information that has been around my entire life into our community. And I got to know Jason Kalipa. He approached me after being at NorCal about a year, and it was the strangest situation. I met him maybe 5 minutes one day in the gym, and then he called me 45 days later, and he said, this is Jason Kalipa. And it was such a surprise because I really had spent maybe 5 minutes of total time in talking to him, and
right.
And he said, "So," and it was strange. He says, "I'm tired of placing last in every endurance event at the CrossFit."
When was this exactly?
So this was January of 2013.
Okay, all right.
And so he's like, "So I'm tired of placing last in every endurance event at the CrossFit Games, and I've tried to solve the problem on my own, and I am coming to you because I'm interested to see if you would be my coach." Now, what's so funny about that is that I had never coached a CrossFit athlete until then. So my athlete number one in the community happened to be a CrossFit Games champion. And so it caught me by surprise. I was nervous all of a sudden that, you know, here's the champ asking me to coach him, and I've never coached a CrossFit athlete before, and so I told him I'd think about it.
That's really interesting. I didn't know it was that recent.
Oh, yeah.
That's fascinating. In 2 years, the growth that you've had and the traction you've had in the community. I don't want to forget to ask you this. I've been curious. So you won the or you got second in the Kona Ironman. What does a typical week look like for that competitive of a triathlete? I just assume you swim, run, bike all day, every day. What exactly does that look like?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So when I started coaching games athletes, one of the things that came up always was the volume of swimming. And when I was a triathlete, and my main background is in swimming, the minimum I would swim every week would be 25,000 meters. Most games athletes will complain if I program them more than 1,500 meters in a week. And it took a long time to calibrate that way because, in the triathlon community, it really is a lot of volume. So 25,000 in the pool was not uncommon. 350 on the bike every week was normal, and then running 50 a week. And then usually what you would do is there would be a travel day and then a race on the weekend, and then you would repeat that for 8 years.
Wait, on the weekend? You mean on how many weekends? How many are you doing every year?
20.
20 in a year. Yeah. Why? Unbelievable.
Yeah, that was just the culture. It was a lot of volume-based, work that you had done. And eventually what happened, though, in the sport was you started to be selective on the races in which you would attack. You would peak at certain times instead of doing races almost like a training event.
Right.
And because competition got tougher and tougher.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so for me, what I ended up doing was really specializing in a couple of events throughout the year, and the main events would be those ones in the fall, like the Ironman in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially mentally, there can't be a way to mentally prepare yourself for the, to win every single time 20 weeks out of the year, right? You have to have some where you're just like, all right, I'm just going to get through this. This is just training, that kind of thing. Is that kind of what it ended up as?
Definitely. I think back on some of those days. It was almost those races felt like an aggressive workout. Mm-hmm. Some workouts that you would do, you'd go on your bike and you'd do a 25-mile time trial as hard as you can. And, you do that in 55 minutes. And that's what these races would feel like to me. They would feel like a very hard effort.
Right.
But then you learned that in order to really dominate, you needed to peak. You needed to do periodization. You needed to create microcycles, macrocycles in your training, and then optimize your taper in order to perform well. And that's where the support has evolved to now. No one is doing 20 races in the year, but that was the norm back in the 80s.
Looking back on it now, would you have entered that many races?
No.
No, okay.
No, I mean, part of it is that you really do learn, and my dad once told me there's no replacement for a little gray hair, right? You learn along the way, right. and you capitalize on that real knowledge. I think that's what helps me as a coach, is that I'm really pulling from information that I've done myself.
Right.
Same thing on the workouts which I program. I do most of the workouts that I program, and that's why they're so tight, because I'm not putting in a bunch of, slush in there, catch-alls. A lot of coaches, what they'll do is they'll program workouts, and they'll say, well, I probably can get away with, 2 minutes of rest here, but I'm going to give them three just in case so that they could actually make the interval. Mm-hmm. So for me, being an athlete and doing the workouts myself, I do things tight. Mm-hmm. And I think that background that I have has really helped me and learning from it and evolving.
Right. Makes you more relatable to the athletes, right?
Yeah. And I think that evolution as a coach and learning, no coach, it's funny. I went to the competitors course with Chris Spieler, Eric, and Chan, and Chris Spieler said no coach has it figured out in our community. He's absolutely right.
Not even close.
Right. There's just so many things that we as coaches need to continuously learn, and CrossFit is is a uniqueness on its own. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that, you know, me in having 7 years in CrossFit has helped, but by no means have I have it figured out at all. Still learning. And that's one of the reasons why I like, you know, voluntarily coaching a lot of athletes is because I pick up a lot of data, which helps me become a better coach.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if he coined this, but my buddy Mike Bledsoe said this is an ever-growing moving target, right?
That's so true.
Dave Castro does a good job of always keeping us on our toes, but for me personally, it keeps it really interesting and it keeps me constantly learning.
I mentioned about Spieler that no coach has it figured out, and Spieler's right. You know that if you think that you do have it figured out, you really don't have a clue.
Right.
For me, you know, one of the things that I recognized is that you need data. I was very I think actually one of the greatest things that's happened in CrossFit is Coach Glassman putting online programming up for free. You know, he had come up with a new fitness methodology in Santa Cruz with a small number of athletes, and he thought that he had something of value. But the problem was is that in order for him to validate his fitness methodology, he had to increase the sample size. And so what did he do? He put it up online, and he did it for free, and people flocked to it by the tens and then the hundreds and then the thousands. And within a very short amount of time, because of the population that was doing it, it validated everything that it was doing. And look what happened.
Right.
I mean, it created an entire industry of phenomenally skilled people, but also on a much lower level, general population, and doing GPP. And for me, when I looked at my approach and just starting with Jason and you know, we had really positive success, right? Jason was finishing last in every endurance event at the games, and then he gets second place on the podium. And that year he won 3 out of the 4 endurance events, and he placed second in the 4th. That had promise, but by no means can you say that you have a new approach with one athlete. Now, we had Garrett Fisher and Neil Maddox, but that wasn't nearly enough. And so for me to open it up with more to validate what I was doing, at least being on the right track, is the direction. And I followed what Coach Glassman did, and that was I'm going to coach any and all athletes for free. And I did that for 2 years. Anybody that came in, I made no money. And it was really strictly solely on let's see whether or not that this approach that I have has merit. And that's why, you know, I still have a lot of athletes that I work with because, you know, once I started with them and they started seeing gains, it's hard for them to leave. Mm-hmm. But they came because it was really an experiment.
Right. Why don't you have every CrossFit athlete yet?
You know, it's so funny. It is a phenomenal amount of work. You know, I was contacted by Rich Froning in November of 2014. And, you know, people come and they, oh, how great is that to be able to coach a Rich Froning? But the anxiety and the stress that I have of taking someone on like that is it's incredible. And the context that you need to think about it is that you've spent, let's say, 2.5 years trying to validate something, and then a Rich Froning comes along, 4 times champion, and what if you do make him faster as a runner, but it comes at a consequence of everything else? What if his numbers go down in terms of his lifts? What if his overall performance in Metcons goes down?
Right.
Okay, so what? You've improved his mile time, but everything else went down? That's not a good methodology.
Right.
And it was incredibly risky to take an athlete like that on.
How's it going?
You know, the thing that I always talk about is whether or not an athlete is coachable. And a coachable athlete is someone who is willing to listen and do the things that you ask, not make modifications, people that are good at communicating. Rich Froning is an incredibly coachable athlete. He listens, he follows direction, he communicates. And because of that, you know, we've had a lot of success together.
That's awesome, man. So if I was a listener and I didn't have any background with you in particular, I would probably be pretty confused, because CrossFit is known as, you know, the pyramid, the base is I'm talking about the pyramid they teach at the level one.
Yep.
The base is what, metabolic or nutrition, then metabolic conditioning. So it's known as it builds your endurance, right? So why are you relevant? Why are people seeking you out? Just go wherever you want with that.
So for me, I look at it more like a funnel. When I, instead of a pyramid, I look at it as a funnel, where at the top of the funnel, an athlete or an individual needs to have GPP. They need to have a baseline, and really CrossFit provides that. You know, they are capable of doing a multitude of things. And once they develop that baseline ability, that baseline level of fitness, they can move down deeper into the funnel. And that's where my work comes in. The first area where I have athletes spend their time, if they have a poor endurance background, I have them spending more time on their feet, low intensity work.
Like what? And what does that look like?
Just long, slow distance training, just building time on their feet. And that could be with walking. I have people that come to me and they can't run yet. And so we start with walking. And then maybe what we'll do is we'll put a small amount of weight on them in terms of a weight vest, and they'll still walk.
And what kind of people are these? Are these like elderly people that are getting off the couch, or are they kind of fit people? What kind of people are you putting a vest on and just having them walk?
Paul Gomez, the one that runs Progenix, he came to me last July, and he wanted to run a 10K in the month of September. Mm-hmm. And that 10K was going to take him at least an hour.
Right.
And in order for him to become effective in terms of managing that time on his feet, I had to find some way of putting a comparable amount of time on his feet.
Right.
So what we did is we did
rather than just sending him on a high volume run.
Right.
Okay.
Because part of it is that you've got to be concerned about injury and. I'm not looking at a short-term approach. I want to keep him motivated and involved and really create a lifestyle change. And if I just look at it and say this is a two-month window, then I would be really negligent in my coaching. I'm looking at it as I really want him to go long-term. And I mean, it's interesting. Here we are a year later, and he's getting ready to run a half marathon next month. But we used a lot of weight vest early on, and 10% of his body weight, and it was a lot of hiking in the hills and trails, and heart rate was at the right point. He was getting the right metabolic stimulus from that, and then what we would do is...
What does that mean?
What we were interested in was really improving his ability of utilizing fat as a fuel so that the hour duration wasn't going to be presenting him a problem in terms of, drops in glycogen and things like that. So what I slowly started having them do was just transition out of wearing a weight vest, and we slowly did jogs in the middle of it. And now the other day he ran 10 miles,
wow.
Which if you know Paul Gomez, I mean, it's and he is one of my coachable athletes too, that is in a handful, top five of my favorite, the people that I work with. And for him, it's almost a miracle to be able to run 10.
Mm-hmm.
He's still CrossFitting 3 days a week.
Yep.
On top of it. That's
phenomenal.
He's
doing a half, you said?
He's doing a half, yeah, in the Big Island. And that's a major goal for him. It's incredible. If you think about his conditioning from the games last year when he contacted me to now, it's incredible. I think that's part of we as coaches, what we need to be focused on is, I mean, in my opinion, the number one thing that I drive for is confidence. I am trying to really create a level of confidence that these athletes have, and that comes from a number of areas, knowledge being one of them. I am really trying to educate these athletes on how to do this on their own.
Right.
The top thing that I'm really steering them to is whatever comes their way, that they can wrap their head around it and they can create a game plan, you know, on how to attack it. And they're confident in that. And so a lot of my workouts are really geared around that, like personalization of pacing. Most CrossFit athletes have no idea when they look at a triple three of how to attack that. How would you attack that last 3 miles? What kind of pace would you do it? And how would you train for that? And so part of what I do is I spend, you know, my time educating them, whatever right. comes their way, how to do an assessment.
That's really interesting, because and that's probably the most interesting topic to me as far as sports go in general, just that psychological piece. And the way I look at it is a lot of communication and teaching people to challenge whether it be fear or just self-doubt in general, that kind of thing. But the education piece is something entirely different that just bleeds into all of their performance, right? If they don't absolutely rely on external things such as a coach, then how much more confident are they going to be, right?
Right. I mean, you know, here's an example. So I have a bunch of athletes that are let's mentally challenged at certain points in a workout. So just take a mile for time. Most athletes, they will quit in that third lap, mm-hmm. right? Because what happens is that third lap is the sticking point, and before they do that mile for time, when they assess that mile, they undervalue the difficulty of that third lap. So when they finally get to that third lap during the actual mile, because they underestimated the amount of suffering that they're going to be in, that they quit. Part of assessing a workout is looking at your own ability and how would you attack that workout? Where is that sticking point? So if you're looking at a mile for time as an example, you know that third lap is going to be difficult. You need to recognize before you start that event that point in time mm-hmm. is going to be the worst.
Right.
And if you calibrate that difficulty, that perceived difficulty, with the actual difficulty when you get there, you'll be successful.
Right.
So part of what I do is in my programming, if I have an athlete that is weak in a particular area mentally, like let's say they have a tendency to back off two-thirds to three-quarters of the way through the workout, then we as coaches, we need to address that. So what I will do is I will do, let's say, a four-part workout on the track. And for simplicity's sake, what I'll do, you know, let's just say it was a part, you know, set one would be an 800, set two would be an 800, and set four would be an 800. But what set three would be, where they normally would quit, would be, let's say, 5 by 200 meters at a very aggressive pace with a small amount of rest. I will force them in that workout okay. to hit that area where they quit the hardest. What I would do is I would create a workout that has four parts, and I would break it out, addressing really the focal point is in the weakness of where the athlete is. So if they typically quit at the three-quarter point, what I will do is I will make that section of the workout very aggressive. So for simplicity, if I did it, let's just say I did an 800 in set one, 800 in set two, and then an 800 in set four. Set three would be 5 by 200 meters at an incredibly aggressive pace. And so it would force them mentally to recognize that when they're thinking of this workout before they do it, they're looking at it on paper and going, that set three is the core of the workout.
Right.
That's the sticking point. That's where I need to focus my time. That's where I need to focus my energy. Don't get distracted on set one and two, and don't be thinking about four.
Right.
Number three is where it's at. And so we as coaches, if there is a weakness in an athlete, all we do is we create programming to really modify that weakness and actually create the stimulus to make it a strength.
Right.
And that's where I spend my time.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I liken it to, you know, going out on a run, like a 3 mile run, you think it is, and it ends up being a 6 mile run. What the difference in those two right? Just having the expectation that you're going on a 3 mile run and it turns into a six makes that 6 mile run shittier.
Yep.
Right. So I guess,
it's the same thing like on Triple Three at the games last year. Okay. You're starting out and you're starting that 3 mile run. Don't kid yourself. When you start that 3 mile run, you are so deep into a workout already. You need to be calibrating yourself of thinking, you know what? I need to have a pace that's similar to what I would be doing at that time domain.
Right.
So, okay.
It's not just a 3 mile run.
Right.
It's a 3 mile run after.
Right. So if it's a 40 minute long event, maybe you should be looking at your pace similar to what you would do a 10K in. Mm-hmm. And so what happened with a lot of people in an event like that is that they were surprised. It's like, well, boy, you know, I'm going way slower than I thought I would be going.
Right. And you can't learn, you have no idea how to deal with that unless you've spent a lot of time using, going at a certain pace, monitoring that pace. It can take some time, can't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think that part of it is for me, when I look at maximizing adaptation, yeah, I really focus on pacing. Mm-hmm. And getting the athlete so that they have a multitude of gears, and they can dial in a particular pace based upon the workout, based upon the time domain, and they can do it without looking at their watch. Mm-hmm. And
huge.
Yeah, I think that early runners, when I meet up with them, they just have running speed. And part of what they need to understand is, like, take the Muscle Up Biathlon at the games last year. That run was a recovery run. Mm-hmm. Well, that run pace also is a pace that someone would do if they were doing a 10-mile event. That recovery pace and training at that, quote, recovery pace is important. So I have athletes train, and you know what? They, like Lindsay Valenzuela, her recovery pace is an 8-minute mile pace. She can recover in any event at an 8-minute mile pace. That is incredibly valuable, and she can do it without looking at a watch.
Right, right. So I want to circle back around to this question. So I see that as a huge, that's a huge benefit, being able to pace in your head, that kind of thing. What physically is the difference in, say, just doing a CrossFit program, doing a CrossFit program and just going out and running as well for extra endurance? And then three, how are you changing it? How are you improving on just doing a CrossFit program and running?
So for me, what I do is I went back and looked at CrossFit and what Glassman did back in the beginning. And it's very clear when you look at his program and you lay out, you know, a month of programming, the amount of oxidative pathway work that was in that original.
For those of us not with a ESS background, what does that mean? What is the oxidative pathway?
Oh, so the oxidative pathway, most of us know the oxidative pathway as the aerobic system, the aerobic energy system, and that is a system where you are getting energy from oxygen. Mm-hmm. Oxygen is entering into the muscle and creating the energy. The opposite extreme of that is the anaerobic energy system. But what Glassman was really doing is he was creating a balance between that anaerobic system and the aerobic system. And now what's happening in CrossFit is that there is a migration because of pressure from people going into the gyms that they want to have that high-intensity experience. Mm-hmm. Myself, I know that if I'm visiting somewhere and I'm not laying on my back at the end of the workout, I feel kind of gypped, right?
Right.
And so they're getting pressure and going to the extreme of the high-intensity side.
Meaning what? Like the 5 to 7 minute range, all out kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And they're forgetting what really Glassman created back in the day, which it's all about balance. Mm-hmm. And creating balance within those metabolic pathways between that anaerobic system and the aerobic system. And so for me, what I do is I specialize in that aerobic system, and I am really interested in maximizing performance within that aerobic system in the least amount of time. Mm-hmm. And that balance, is what is creating these levels of performance that these games athletes have never seen before. I mean, for me, by doing that, we the levels of gains, for example, like a Lauren Fisher, amazing CrossFit athlete, but 7 months with me, you know, just by working on that oxidative pathway, her mile time improved 40 seconds.
Wow.
Lindsay Valenzuela, podiums, right, at the CrossFit Games, 12 months after working on just two workouts a week, oxidative pathway, low intensity, her mile time has improved over a minute. Yeah, that balance is really important. And for me, I never push the high intensity side because that's what's commonly done in the gym. So my athletes are rarely doing maximum efforts, maximum time trials. What we are really interested in doing is maximizing their speed at their maximum sustainable pace. That's what I'm interested in.
So how does someone like Rich Froning, he's the fittest man in the world four times, I mean, he's got amazing endurance. He wins, you know, he won the Open 2 or 3 years in a row. How do you, specifically, how do you improve on his endurance? How have you?
So
what's going on metabolically, physiologically, that's that you're trying to change?
So the key is that for everybody, they need to do an assessment of whether or not they need more speed in their diet, you know, speed, strength, power, or whether or not they need more aerobic efficiency. They need to improve their aerobic system. And the way I do it is because I was fascinated, like when I watched the games on Rich Froning, that how is it possible that he wins the games, you know, and this is all reflecting afterwards. Did that happen at, you know, where he started walking? It just, to me, I wanted, and I didn't know, you know, what his strengths and weaknesses were. I don't. And every athlete, when you get to know them, they do have strengths and weaknesses. And Rich, I was really interested. And when I started working with him, I did the same thing with him that I do with every athlete. I'm interested in a short distance event, like a 400 for time. That's a very anaerobic, it's usually about 50-50 anaerobic aerobic. And then I take a mostly aerobic distance, such as a mile for time, and I look at the relationship between those two events. More specifically, what I'm looking for is how much is their speed slowing down from 400 meters to the mile. Now, back in the 70s, a guy by the name of Regal, he came out and he said, you know, runners, there's a relationship between their rate of slowing. For every doubling of the distance that they go.
Who was that?
A guy by the name of Pete Regal.
Okay.
And it's published in Runner's World, and they he found that on an elite level in the running community, runners slow down at a rate of around 6% for every doubling of the distance that they run. Now, in all of my work, and that was one of the reasons of having a large sample size, is CrossFitters are not elitist, right? They're not trying to specialize in being a runner. And so 6% is an elite level runner. What would it be for CrossFit? And what I'm finding is that that number, it's somewhere in that 20% range. So for every doubling of the distance that a solid CrossFit athlete would go from 400 to 800 and then 800 to a mile, I'd like to see him slow around at 20%. Now, when Jason came on board, his rate of slowing was around 26.5%. So that told me that his weakness was, because that number was so high, he needed to work more on his oxidative pathway, develop a better aerobic system. Now, myself, my number when I started doing CrossFit was around 8%. So what did that tell me? I need more speed in my diet. Right. I need more power in my diet. And that was work that I never even worked on. It's obvious. So when I got Rich Froning's number, his 400 time was 60 seconds. Not bad. His mile time was a minute. I mean, 6 minutes. So he was running 60 seconds for a 400. And individually, they sound really good.
Right.
But the relationship between the two of them is what I was interested in.
What does that put him at? Like a
28%.
Okay. Yep.
Now, that's probably the worst number that I've ever seen. And it wasn't a surprise based upon that he had an underdeveloped aerobic system in comparison to his speed. So for me, it highlighted his potential. That Rich Froning, with a small amount of proper training, I can improve his mile time down to 5:20. Small amount. And what I'm talking about is 2 days a week, maybe running 6 to 7 miles a week. That's it. And so, yeah, it was exciting for me. I mean, when you see a number like that at 28%, I mean, as a coach, you're like, wow, I can make this guy solid.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, he is highly coachable. And because of that, his improvement has been dramatic.
There's a sharp change in subject, but you and I talk a lot about the relationship of VO2 max and lactate threshold difference, and you know, what like kind of the biggest bang for our buck training wise. Can you speak to that a little bit? What is each, and how do you train both?
So most of my games level athletes, they'll go out and they'll get their VO2 max tested. VO2 max, what it is it's the maximum amount of oxygen that you could bring in from the atmosphere and push through your muscle. Everybody has a limit. It's like a maximum heart rate. And the way they test this is that you wear a mask that measures your oxygen and carbon dioxide, and they put you typically on a treadmill. And they gradually increase the intensity, speed, and grade goes up as you increase the amount of time. And what they do is you continue, and they're looking at your oxygen consumption. So as the intensity grows, it goes up, your demand for more oxygen goes up. Eventually, you hit a peak, and it tells you how much oxygen that you are able to process. That number with high-intensity training, CrossFit, you can actually increase it to your genetic limit. In some cases, you know, you can increase it, you know, 20%+. Most elite CrossFit athletes tap out on that potential, you know, after a couple years in the sport.
Okay. Okay.
And they hit their maximum. So they're not going to increase any more percentage, but the, I mean, in total quantity. But the question really is, and this is where I come in, what percentage of that number it becomes their sustainable pace? Because that VO2 max is a maximum, and you're not going to hit that max until you maybe hit your finishing kick, right? And you're seconds from laying on the floor.
Right.
So the question is what is your sustainable pace?
Right. So how close can I get to that max without burning out?
That's
right?
Correct. So I've had Matt Chan tested, and he's comfortable with me talking about it. Because of his accident, it was after his accident, that his maximum sustainable pace, which lactate threshold, you know, that when you get to that threshold level, lactate threshold, essentially think of it as the death zone when you're climbing Everest. If you stay below that death zone, you're fine. But if you go above that, eventually your body's going to shut you down and you'll eventually die. That threshold is really the same thing. You can go above it, but eventually your body's going to shut you down and push you below that limit.
Once you reach that threshold, it's a quick drop, right?
Right.
Performance. Yep.
Right. So you have an ability, though, of increasing that threshold higher and higher and pushing it up towards your VO2 max.
Right.
So Matt Chan had a lactate threshold number at 72%. Okay,
gotcha.
Very low. Now, since Julie Fouché is you know, migrating out of the sport, I could talk about it. Julie Fouché has one of the most impressive aerobic systems I have ever seen. Her number is 95%.
Jesus.
So she has a phenomenally high VO2 max, but her lactate threshold number relative to her VO2 max is 95%. That means that Julie Fouché can operate until her glycogen stores are gone at 95%.
Incredible.
Of her, that's why she's so dominant.
Incredible.
Yeah, so there's, like I said earlier, every athlete has its strengths and weaknesses, and Julie Fouché is a phenomenal, phenomenal endurance athlete. I mean, that's a testament to Doug Chapman, and what he has done is, you know, there's a lot of volume on that side, and it has really developed that side of the equation for her.
Right. So you said 2 years doing CrossFit workouts, you can get that VO2 max kind of to, you can tap it out, right? You can reach your genetic potential.
And you'll start seeing gains in that VO2 max within 9 weeks. I mean, it's right. Something that happens fast. The improvements in lactate threshold, because those are more metabolic cellular level changes, right? On a mitochondria level, capillaries, all of that, right? Take more time, 20, 24 weeks. But those are also adaptable. So somebody who has tapped their VO2, I spend my time in trying to maximize, like Matt Chan. Matt Chan has an ability of moving that 72 up into the 90s. Mm-hmm. That is pure performance gain.
So how do the two trainings, how do they differ? What does it look like? What does a VO2 max based workout look like? And what does a lactate threshold based workout look like?
Dude, that's an awesome question. So as a coach, the coolest thing is that if you identify a weakness, then like take Matt Chan, that's a weakness. For me, it's easy now that I know what the weakness is to create a stimulus to make that into a strength. So what do I do if his weakness is his lactate threshold percentage? I program workouts that have an intensity that is in and around that lactate threshold. The more time he spends at that threshold, then the greater the level of adaptation.
Right.
And what I'm trying to do is slowly move that up from 72 to 75 to 80 into the 90s.
Right.
So what I do is a lot of workouts and a lot of time that are just below, at, and above that number. It's a range.
Right around there.
I mean, it's, you need to have some above, because if you don't, the bar will never get pulled up.
Right.
So paced workouts such as if, and I would never program this something this boring, but let's say it was 10 by 400 meters, it would all be at one standardized pace. So let's say it's, you know, you're doing them at 130s. Every single interval that I would have them do would be at 400 at 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. And the first couple of them would be easy for him, but pretty soon it would be at threshold, and then the last ones would be above it. And so a lot of the workouts, those lactate threshold workouts that I program, are based on that. The other area, like you had mentioned, is VO2 max. I am really interested in developing the pace that athletes can run at when they get to VO2 max. The key is that if I put you on the track and I said, hey, I want you to run 400 meters as fast as you possibly can, at the end of that 400 meters, I can get you to your VO2 max number. Mm-hmm. I can't. I can get you at 100% of it. But what value is that in terms of training? What I'm interested in is how slow can I make you run and still get you to VO2 max? So in other words, you're going to run at a speed that is the slowest speed that you can run at, but eventually you will get to that VO2 max number. Mm-hmm. So a lot of data and the work that I do is I put someone and have them run 6 minutes and on the track, and I have them document how far they actually went. Now, typically in 6 minutes, that turns out to be that minimum speed that you run, and you will still get to VO2 max. So that is a typical number. So take, for example, and you know, in my seminar I talk about this, is you know, Rich Froning, I have a VO2 max, and I'm 52 years old at 62. Rich Froning has bumped his, with our work, from 62 to 72. So he's at a VO2 of higher than me. The question, though, is that Rich Froning has a higher VO2 max than me, but can he beat me in any running event? And the answer is no. So why is that? Rich Froning's speed at VO2 max is substantially less than mine. So at VO2 max, when he runs 6 minutes, he's covering 4.47 meters per second. I cover over 5 meters per second. So what I'm interested in doing is, Rich has a great VO2 max, but his speed at VO2 max is slow. My job is to increase that speed at his VO2 max pace.
I mean, and that has to do with a lot of things, right? Running mechanics, lactate threshold, all of that stuff, body weight, all of that kind of stuff, right?
Right, but it also, it really has to do with the stimulus and the speed that he's training at. And okay. So when I will program workouts, I will look at that rate of speed that is that it really maximizes adaptation. Mm-hmm. And that's a weakness of most CrossFit athletes is that minimum speed that will get them to VO2 max. And right. So most of my programming is in and around that, as well as the speed at lactate threshold.
Gotcha.
So people, that's what they think is that, you know, they call this long, slow distance training. And there's a lot of, unfortunately, misinformation in our community about long, slow distance. Yeah, this is kind of considered, you know, it's oxidative pathway, long or slow distance training. But, you know, go to Julie Fouché. Yeah, at these intervals that she is doing, okay, it's long, slow distance interval training, but it's still 94-95% of her maximum.
Wow.
It hurts her real bad.
Right, right.
But she's just incredibly efficient. And so, yeah, don't be confused when you're looking at these things and go, oh, that's, you know, not maximum effort work. It's not high intensity like in the gym. It's hard work.
Right. I mean, it's brutal work, especially just the mental side to repeatedly push yourself right to that limit is it's scary sometimes.
Well, and then to be able to hold it, right? So I am part of what I really want people to understand is they need to look at a workout. I mean, here's the thing. Of all the things, if I only have, like take Camille. If she says, I only want to do 3 endurance workouts in a week, of all the million things that I can do for her, why that one? She needs to look at it and go, this I get it, and this provides value to me. And a lot of people, what they're doing is they're going to the track and you know, they're hearing, you know, oh, I'm going to go to the track and I'm going to run, you know, 400 and I'm going to hit that first one as hard as I can. I'm going to take my allotted rest and then I'm going to hit the next one as hard as I can and then the third one as hard as I can and then I'm pretty much done because I can't do any more hard ones. And what they've done is they've hurt real bad on all 3 of those, but their speed has slowed because they're more and more fatigued as they progress into the workout. I'm not sure what that taught your body, right? What you did is you hurt real bad and you ran real slow. What we're really trying to do with pace type of workouts is maximize the overall workout volume. So if I gave 10 by 400 meters and, you know, I wanted you to hold 130 on every single one of those, I'm interested in your performance deep into the workout, right? So at 4,000 meters, how fast are you running? Because I'm interested in maximizing your speed at that specific volume.
Right.
Do I care what they do on rounds 1, 2, and 3? Of course not. They're meaningless. Your energy systems are filled.
Right.
I want to know when you're depleted, when you're fatigued, how fast are you? Mm-hmm. That's real progress.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and it's not... That's not speed work. Those first 3, you're treating almost as speed work. But if you're going to do speed work...
Then do speed work.
Yeah, exactly. Go as fast as you possibly can, right?
Right. Yeah, so those things, like for me, those workouts, because I am... I have plenty of endurance. My aerobic system is highly efficient because of just the years of work. That's the type of workout that I need. So if I have an athlete who is 60 years old... and I'm looking at their stride length and that becomes their limiting factor, I need to be doing things where they're doing 40-meter sprints, 60-meter sprints. I need to work on their power output, hills, sleds, things like that, because that's their weakness.
Right.
But the majority of people within the CrossFit community, 95% of the people, mm-hmm. need more of that aerobic side, and what they need to do is they need to maximize their speed deep into the workouts. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to teach some people because a 10 by 400 is a great workout, and if you do it like you just said, by going as hard as you can every interval, you're gonna be flat on your back at the end of it for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think there's just a lack of understanding about why, or that just the fact that there is a more efficient way to improve your aerobic capacity, right? Yeah. There's a lack of information, and what I see you doing better than anyone else I've ever met is educating people for free, whether it be elite level athletes or you know, your average Joe. You give away a ton of free information, and I think that is slowly starting to trickle into the larger community. People can you know, much more quickly improve their endurance by doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, thanks. I you know, I give all of my knowledge away. Mm-hmm. All of my research that I've done, if you come to one of my seminars, I will share everything that I have. I don't, the only thing I don't talk about is from an elite level, the games athletes, some of them limit, you know, what I can talk about. Mm-hmm. But everything else, it's open season, and yeah, I really do give back to the community. You know, I am so grateful for, you know, when I started CrossFit, I was really beat up and damaged, and from just the mountain of work that I did in my triathlon days, and CrossFit helped me restore my health and become functional again, and for that I'm grateful. And that is the underlying factor of everything that I do, that if I have an opportunity to pay it forward, I'm going to do it. I am not driven by, you know, and the underlying fact is not about money. It's about really paying it forward. And that's what this community is all about. And we see it over and over again. Yeah, I think that the change, though, because I have had so many athletes come my way, I feel like the programming and this and the things that I am doing is in the right direction.
Right.
I really think that one of the things about Brute that is so fantastic, you know, when we talked at the games last year about this, I think the thing that is so incredible is we're all about efficiency these days, no matter who you are. And if you are a 50-year-old man and you're working 60 hours a week, you don't have a lot of time. And if I have only 4 hours a week to exercise, I want that to be the highest and best use of my time. That's what I'm interested in.
Right.
And I want to go to people who are experts in their given area that know that how am I going to improve my aerobic efficiency? How am I going to improve my aerobic system so when I go, you know, traveling to Nepal for my 2 weeks of vacation, that I'm not going to have problem hiking in, you know, the Himalayas, right?
Right.
That's what I want to know. And for me, in the direction where Brute is going, it's really looking at, of all the options that we have available to us in terms of workouts, why these?
Right.
And specialists no more than generalists.
Absolutely.
Do.
And it would be so easy just to take, say, you know, you, Nick Sorrell, Matt Bruce, and you all write a program, a perfect program to improve someone's running, muscle ups, and snatch, and just throw them all together. The real trick is everybody has to figure out how we can work together.
Yep.
Because, you know, these athletes can't just do all of it all the time.
Right.
And that's the art in it.
Yeah, and I think that's why Brute is so successful, is because it takes somebody at a high level of these of organizing these specialists, you know, and I'll put myself in as the endurance specialist. I'm biased, right? I feel like mine should have a certain weighting over somebody else's, and that's where, you know, the leaders within Brute of taking this information and consolidating it and putting it into the correct format and the correct weighting becomes critical, right? So they really do, the athlete that comes in is getting the best of everything, right? You're getting the knowledge of the specialist, but then you're really getting an expert in how to put all those pieces together.
Right. Well, I sure hope so.
I hope that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Awesome, man. I really appreciate this. I feel like we can have a few more of these in the future for sure. Where can they find you? What is it, just aerobiccapacity.com, your own website?
It is. So aerobiccapacity.com. There is online programming that is in there that is just running-based. There's going to be a rowing-based endurance program. It's two workouts a week, just if you want to have supplementary work in your diet. then there's also seminars that I'm doing, like I mentioned earlier. All of the information and the knowledge that I have picked up over the last 3+ years is given out in this. We cover it all. It's a 4-hour seminar, and those are, you can sign up for there as well.
On AC.com.
Yep.
AeroCapacity.com.
Yep.
What's your Instagram?
It's Hinshaw363.
363. Is that the best one to follow? Most active on there?
That's pretty good.
Awesome, man.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yep. Thanks.